Season 4, Episode 23. This is Black History Moments, a podcast dedicated to telling the stories of those who have been forgotten or who are lesser known in our history books and texts. Happy Black History Month. If you are new here, I'm Shakira White, an HBCU graduate and lover of all things Black and historical. Before RuPaul and Marsha P. Johnson, before Bayard Rustin and Gladys Bentley, there was William Dorsey Swan. William was born into slavery but later moved to D.C., where they connected with the underground Black queer community. At a time when people felt the crossroads and hatred of being both Black and queer, William created the first documented drag ball in the United States. A police raid and failed pardon from the president ignited William and William's House of Swan. This is their story. William Dorsey Swan was born into slavery in Washington County, Maryland, around 1858 to 1860. It's speculated that William was born between those years because this was pre-Emancipation Proclamation days, so records for things like this, births, deaths, everything in between, can be kind of hazy. William was the fifth of 13 children, and their mom's name was Mary Jane Yonker, who was also enslaved, and their dad's name was Andrew Jackson, or Jack Swan, and he was also enslaved as a wheat farmer. The plantation that the family, quote-unquote, belonged to was owned by a white woman named Anne Murray. But when William was around 2 years old, their family was freed under the D.C. Compensated Emancipation Act. Now, if you're anything like me and you had no idea that there was a D.C. Compensated Emancipation Act, here is a little background on that. In December of 1861, Henry Wilson, who was a junior Massachusetts senator, introduced a bill in Congress to end slavery in Washington, D.C. When he introduced the bill, many congressmen and residents of D.C. had a fit because they, at this time, still legally owned their own slaves. However, despite all of their opposition, the bill passed and the Senate approved it on April 3rd, 1862, followed by the House of Representatives a few days later on April 12th, 1862. President Lincoln signed the legislation on April 16th of that year, and that was just 4 days after it passed the House of Representatives. Now, this was months before the Emancipation Proclamation the following year. See, the idea was, how can we be fighting and arguing to free enslaved people in the United States when there are people right in our backyard, you can say, who are enslaved? It's kind of like a pot calling the kettle black kind of thing. The act was titled An Act for the Release of Certain Persons Held to Service or Labor in the District of Columbia. And once it passed, it freed 3,100 women, children, and men who were still enslaved in D.C., the District of Columbia, in 1862. Now, the act also allowed for those that owned slaves to be compensated up to $300 for each individual that they had legally owned. Also, if you're anything like me, you may be thinking, $300 per enslaved person, how much would that be today? And I'm glad you asked, because according to our inflation calculator, that's around $9,160 today. $9,160. So take Anne Murray, for example, who legally owned William's family. If she was compensated for William's entire family, that's mom, dad, and children, that would be about $137,400. just for William's family, and I'm not taking into account any other enslaved individuals on her plantation. So let's just let that sink in for a second. Also in this act, newly freed African Americans could receive up to $100 if they chose to immigrate to another country. And so that's a little bit on the DC Compensated Emancipation Act. After the act was set into place, Anne Murray released William's family, so the parents, Mary and Jack, they purchased a plot of land that was not too far from the plantation that they once lived on, and they started their own farm. Growing up, William found employment as a hotel waiter nearby before he later moved to Washington, D.C., where he found work as a janitor. And William worked hard and often sent money back to his family while they were at the home on the farm. And here is where our story picks up a bit. William spends a few years in D.C. working and doing their thing until they become involved with the underground queer movement in the city, and they start hosting parties. According to Business Insider, the early days of what would become known as the House of Swan were far from luxurious. At the time, cross-dressing or face disguise was punishable by law, so invitations were disseminated by hushed word of mouth at local YMCAs. And I believe we talked a bit about the YMCA's place in the queer movement in our episode on Marsha P. Johnson. You can check that out next if you want to learn more about Marsha's story. But the gatherings were often subject to police raids. People who attended, they risked their reputations and their freedoms by being at the balls. And police documents show that sentencing ranged anywhere from 3 to 10 months just for attending. But despite all of this, William's parties are the first documented drag balls in American history. William loved this thing that used to happen at Emancipation Day celebrations. So after the Emancipation Proclamation, Washington, D.C. would have these annual gatherings or celebrations where they would celebrate the ending of slavery. All of the Black people would gather together. One thing that would happen at these celebrations was a crowning, and William was obsessed with this. The annual celebrations would have a neighborhood being represented by a woman who, quote unquote, personified freedom for Black people, and they would have been called the Queens of Freedom. Seeing this, William was inspired and used the concept to start crowning the winners of his dance competitions as the Queen of the Ball. Now, I know I just said dance competitions and balls and parties in relation to what William was hosting, but that's because they were all one in the same. At the balls William hosted, they would have a dance competition that I found so interesting. Here's an excerpt from Smithsonian Magazine. At Swan's gatherings, guests donned women's clothing or men's suits and danced to folk music. The balls included a competitive element, a resistance dance, that harkened back to the antebellum era. Known as a cakewalk, the contest was originally held by enslaved people on southern plantations. Coupled dancers executed walking steps and figures in precise formations as if in mimicry of the white man's attitudes and manners. Enslavers, seemingly unaware that they were being mocked, judged the contest and gave the winning couple a cake as a surprise. One thing I also want to say here is that I had no idea that that is where the term cakewalk came from. You know, when you hear, oh, this will be a cakewalk, or that's a cakewalk. I had no idea that cakewalk actually derived from slavery days and that this was the real meaning of a cakewalk, or this was where that term came from. I had no idea. We learn something new every day. So let's recap to bring all of this together. I know we just went through a lot of information. William moves to DC to work and becomes involved in the underground queer community there. William starts throwing drag parties where they would gather butlers, cooks, and other service workers together for the parties. And because they were illegal, the parties were spread through word of mouth, usually via the YMCA. At William's parties, they would crown queens because they loved the idea that came from the Emancipation Parades in DC. Okay, so I think we're caught up. Let's take it to a pivotal night in William's story. One night, William was hosting another one of their drag balls, and by this time, word had spread to police and law enforcement of what was going down at William's place. It's important to note here that although there were laws across many cities in the country that outlawed or banned cross-dressing, the laws were applied very selectively. In other words, if it were done by white citizens of the country, the police were willing to kind of turn a blind eye or act like it goes unnoticed. But if you were not white, you were more likely to be on their radar, caught and charged for these acts. So one night at William's house, they're having one of the drag balls, and there were a few men there. They're dancing, having a great time, dressed in what was later described as female attire of many colors, as well as, quote, gaudy costumes of silk and satin. And there is a knock at the door. And not just any knock, a police knock. I don't know if you've ever experienced a police knock on the door, but let me tell you, it is a very distinct knock. So the police storm in, William rushes towards the door to try to attempt to keep them from entering and also to let the others escape. They started jumping out of windows, started ripping the garments off of themselves, all while William is trying their best to keep the police at bay so the others can get away. The police scatter throughout the place and arrest everyone that they can catch. And the next day, an article was published in the newspaper about the evening, and it reads, "Colored Men in Female Attire." That's the title. "Police Raid on a Dancing Party." Last night, a party of colored men gave a ball in a house near the corner of 12th and F Streets Northwest. Most of them appeared in female attire of many colors. The dance was in progress between 11 and 12 o'clock when Lieutenant Amiss with a squad of officers appeared and brought the ball to a sudden termination. The men in female attire began to drop their gaudy costumes of silk and satin, and several of them jumped through the back window and escaped. The officers arrested 11 of them after a struggle and locked them up. This morning, the prisoners were followed to the police court by a large crowd of persons, and when the case was called, the courtroom was crowded. The prisoners, who gave their names as John Smith, Jake Byard, William Dorsey, Charles Myers, John Lewis, Samuel Jackson, James Waters, James Howard, James Taylor, Benjamin Moore, and Albert Lee, were arraigned on the charges of vagrancy. They stood in the dock with their faces hid from view. The officers gave their testimony and showed the court several silk and satin dresses, which they picked up where the men left them. They were sentenced to give bonds or each go down for 30 days. On January 1st, 1896, William Swan was charged with keeping a disorderly house, which in other terms was running a brothel, and also charged with impersonating a woman. And the newspapers revealed it for what it was, which was that Swan was actually holding a drag ball. According to the National Archives, after pleading not guilty, a speedy trial and conviction followed on January 3rd, 1896, just 2 days later, and William was sentenced to 300 days in jail to expire with good time in September 1896. Now, 3 months into his sentence, Swan filed a petition of pardon to President Grover Cleveland, pleading that he was a respectable worker with a long record of continuous employment, and that the sentence was severe to the crime, and that if released, he would, quote, live a proper and law-abiding life, end quote. So for their petition, 30 of their friends and allies, which were quite possibly also members of the drag and queer community, signed the petition in show of support for William. However, the U.S. attorney, A.A. Burney, argued against the petition by stating, quote, the prisoner was in fact convicted of the most horrible and disgusting offenses known to the law. An offense so disgusting that it is unnamed. This is not the first time that the prisoner has been convicted of this crime, and his evil example in the community must have been most corrupting. End quote. And as a result, William's petition was denied. I want to pause here by saying, to think that this, hosting a drag ball, was the most evil and horrific thing a person could be convicted of is quite possibly the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. Seriously. There is a beautiful line in an article that I read while I was researching, and I want to share it with you. Swan and his companions did not have the luxury of being able to publicly congregate in bars, hence the creation of the House of Swan, an area where they could socialize and be social with one another without facing public hostility, a place where they could dismantle their double battle of being Black and LGBTQ, a space where they could be visible to each other, yet still remain invisible to the general public, end quote. These were people who were living in the days of Jim Crow, where you were viewed as being less than human. You were deemed to only be good enough for service jobs, and you weren't allowed to be yourself if that meant anything other than being a straight man or woman. The newspaper articles publishing the names of all of those attending the drag parties put them at risk of danger, because we know the history of this country. Marjorie Morgan wrote, Swan's demand for a pardon made them the first recorded American to take political and legal steps to defend the LGBTQ community's right to gather without threat of state or individual violence. Swan consistently resisted the censorship of their drag balls and continued to organize and hold events in Washington, D.C. for several years. Swan was sentenced in 1896 to 10 months in prison for the false charge of keeping a disorderly house, again also known as running a brothel. And Marjorie said this so eloquently that I wanted to share it with you. The House of Swan was where people once treated as property and subjected to the harsh existence of serving every whim of the white supremacist colonial structures of capitalism became queens in their own worlds. They moved from the fields and positions of service to the finery of satin gowns, extravagant hats, shoes, gloves, and wigs. And because this was a time that drag wasn't understood, William Dorsey Swan did everything to continue to create a safe haven for those who could not be themselves in the outside world. This was decades before the Stonewall riots, before Marsha P. Johnson, and we talk about Marsha in a previous episode that I welcome you to check out after this one. But William helped cultivate that space. Channing Gerard Joseph, who wrote a book on William's life titled The House of Swan, Where Slaves Became Queens, said that Swan felt defeated and likely unable to find work given his growing infamy. William retired from Washington's queer underground by 1900 and returned home to Hancock. But there is a plot twist here, because William's brother, Daniel J. Swan, continued William's work by costuming the DC drag community as a tailor and continued to host drag parties up until his death in 1954. So he took on William's job. Once William had had enough, Daniel took it on. William, on the other hand, passed away in December of 1925, but William left behind a lifetime of perseverance and fight to cultivate a space for queer Black people in a world that failed to understand or accept them for who they were. And that is the story of the House of Swan and the first queen of drag, William Dorsey Swan. I hope that you share this episode with someone and that you remember that you too are Black history. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a 5-star review. It helps us be discovered so that others can hear the stories of the people that we talk about. You can follow our pages for daily Black history figures throughout the month of February at Black History Moments on Instagram and Facebook. This podcast was written and produced by me, Shakira White. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.